know that we are in the middle of a series on Pirkei Avos and learning lots of important lessons from the Mishnayos that we are studying. However, this week, being that it's our final shiur before Hanukkah, I thought it was something that would be of interest to all of us to talk about an issue that relates to Hanukkah, but something that has become a very relevant and widely discussed issue in halacha in recent months and years. So let us begin with the following very famous question of the Beis Yosef. Whenever we come to the time of year of Hanukkah, you know, it's like each yomtiv, each holiday in the year has its own question. So Hanukkah, the most famous question that is asked is, why is it that we celebrate and we commemorate the great miracle of Hanukkah for 8 days, if in fact the miracle was only 7 days long? If they found one jug of oil in the Beis HaMikdash, and that jug of oil was able to last them for 1 day, for one night, why is it that we now have a commemoration of 8 days of celebration to show the great miracle that took place? There were really only 7 days of miracles that we experienced. Now the truth is, there is a further question that is not as well known, and that is, why is it that on every other holiday throughout the year, Pesach, Shavuot, Sukkot, Rosh Hashanah, we always have what we refer to as Yom Tov Sheni Shel Galuyos? For those of us who are living in Chutz La'aretz, we observe an extra day because we're not exactly sure which calendaric date is the proper date. So we always add on an extra day to make sure we're doing it properly. If that is the case, why is it that on Hanukkah we don't have 9 days of Hanukkah? Right? We really should have 9 days the same way we would add on an extra day. So there are those who say, I don't think it's the correct answer, but there are some who suggest, well, maybe that's why we have 8 days of Hanukkah. Because really it's supposed to be seven to commemorate the 7 days of miracles, and we added an eighth day just in case, and that's why we have 8 days of Hanukkah. That really cannot be the answer, because if that was the case, then in Israel, the same way they only have 1 day of Yom Tov, they would only have 7 days of Hanukkah. And that is not certainly not the case, and we've never heard of such a thing. So it's a good question. Why do we not observe 9 days of Hanukkah? But what we are going to discuss is, why is it that we observe 8 days of Hanukkah when really it should only be seven? So the Beis Yosef, Rabbi Yosef Karo, the author of the Shulchan Aruch, writes, the answer is as follows. He suggests a number of different possibilities, but the answer that he gives is the following. They found this little jug of oil, as we mentioned last week, the history that led up to that. They found the one jug of oil, everybody was so excited. They're now going to rededicate the Beis HaMikdash, they're going to light the menorah once again, and they put the oil into the menorah, and as they were filling up a little bit, suddenly the rest of the cup fills up with miraculous oil. And therefore they had enough to burn for 8 days, because every day when they went to pour whatever they would consider to be the amount that was necessary, all they had to put in was a drop of oil, and the rest of the cup in the actual menorah filled up with miraculous oil. Therefore, says the Beis Yosef, it was an incredible miracle even on the first day. It was something unusual that they all saw visually. They experienced the miracle. They watched it happen. And therefore, the Beis Yosef says, this is why we commemorate the miracle for 8 days, because even the first day was a miracle as well. The problem with that answer is, as we know, the Torah says, when you light the menorah in the Beis HaMikdash, there are very specific guidelines and instructions of what is able to be used. What material can a person put in to those cups of the menorah in order to make them burn? And we know the Torah says it has to be shemen zayis zach kasis lama'or, which means you have to take oil that is squeezed out from olives, not only squeezed out from any olives, it has to be the first drop from every olive that you squeeze, which is very highly unusual oil that most people don't have in their homes. That is what the Torah requires of us to use to light in the Beis HaMikdash. And therefore the question is, how is it even acceptable if we're now going to have this miraculous oil that fills up the cup that is not Shemen Zayis Zach Kasis Lama'ar? Which leads us into an extremely rich and expansive discussion. Something, as we mentioned, that has become a very relevant issue in halacha in the last couple of months. And I will explain as follows. I'm sure many of us have heard, don't confuse this with something else because it's not the same. I'm sure many of us have read the New York Times articles and all the discussion that's ensued over the last few months about the stem cell burger or the stem cell meat. Have many of us been familiar with that? So this is a major halachic discussion that we'll get into throughout the course of this year, and it really comes from our very conversation that we're having regarding the Neiros Chanukah and the Beis HaMikdash. So let us begin with the following preface. We have Avraham Avinu, as we know, was very engaged in the mitzvah of Hachnasas Archim. And the Torah tells us that he invites in the three malachim who come to his home, and he makes a feast for them. But when you look carefully at what it is that he served, it's a very problematic menu. So let's look at the pasuk together, number Aleph. Parshas Vayera, the Torah tells us as follows. Ve'el ha-bakar ratz Avraham. Avraham Avinu himself goes to get the bakar, is the cattle. Vayikach ben ha-bakar rach batov, and he takes something that was from the choicest ones that was out there in his field. Now, it just happens to be that Avraham Avinu himself goes and prepares it. It seems that he doesn't send somebody else to do the work for him. That shows us how one is supposed to be involved in chesed. Don't delegate the responsibility to other people. Allow yourself to be the one who is involved in the chesed. And don't think that just because it's going to get done, that that is the best way to do it. You should try and be involved yourself. So Avraham Avinu himself goes out. Vayitein el hanar. But then after he goes and he gets it, he gives it over to his child. Vayimaher la'aso. And he quickly goes to prepare this dish of whatever meat it was that he was making for them. Then we're told, Vayikach chema v'chalav, which means he takes butter and milk, uven habakar asher asa, and then he takes the delicious meat that he had now prepared, Vayitein lifnehem, so he comes out to the table and he serves them what in our homes would be called treif. So he goes and he serves them basar v'chalav. One second. Okay. V'hu omed aleihem tachas ha'etz vayochelu. So Avraham Avinu is standing there. He's the waiter. He's making sure they have everything. But the problem is that he serves them something that is not an acceptable food as Jews to eat. So you ask a very good question. This was hundreds of years before the Torah was given. So what is the issue? Avraham Avinu could have served them anything. Why should we even be concerned? So the Gemara has a comment in Maseches Yuma, as well as a Maseches Kiddushin, that we assume Kiyem Avraham Avinu kol ha-Torah kula kodem shednitna. The assumption is that Avraham Avinu somehow figured out all the laws of the Torah before they were even given. And the assumption is that he kept and he observed all the laws of the Torah before they were given. And therefore, says the Gemara, since that is the working assumption, now we have a problem. How do we deal with the fact that Avraham Avinu did something that is against an open verse in the Torah where we're instructed not to cook basar b'chalav, not to serve basar b'chalav, and not to have any benefit from basar b'chalav, from milk and meat. So how is Avraham Avinu allowed to do this? Many grapple with this question, many different suggestions, but the Malbim writes the following comment on Chumash, and he says, if you'll notice, you look carefully at the pasuk, look again at what it says. Vayimaher la'aso so. Avraham Avinu goes out into the field, he takes a cow, he takes some kind of animal, and he wants to go and prepare it. Vayimaher, and he hurries, la'aso. How do you translate that word? No, translate it literally. To make it? He didn't make the animal. He cooked the animal, he shechted the animal, whatever he did. Ask the Malbim, what do you mean? Vayimaher, la'aso, says the Malbim, here's the answer. We have this miraculous concept called Sefer Hayitzira, which means that Avraham Avinu figured out how to create an animal out of nothing, and he created this miraculous animal, Vayimaher la'aso. He actually made it. He made this animal. And therefore writes the Malbim, you're laughing, but you'll see in a minute. One second. So says the Malbim, he made this animal through Sefer Hayitzira. Like the Gemara tells us a story about one of the Amoraim who didn't have money. He couldn't afford to buy chicken and meat for Shabbos. So every Erev Shabbos, no problem. He created his own animal out of nothing. And then he went and he served it to his family. Avraham Avinu knew how to do the same thing, says the Gemara, just like one of those Amoraim did, and therefore writes the Malbim, that's what he did. That animal is not fleshig, that's not really an animal. And therefore Avraham Avinu had no problem to go and serve this animal together with the butter and the cheese and the milk. It was totally acceptable, not an issue of basar b'chalav at all. That is the answer that the Malbim gives. How do you explain what? That he went vayikach, and he took. So that's the issue that I have as well with the Malbim, but that's what the Malbim writes. He says that Avraham Avinu went and created this. Now, it could be that he had a whole farm of these animals roaming around, and he went and he took one of them. It's possible. I don't know exactly. But that's what the Malbim writes. And this is quoted lehalacha. This Malbim is actually quoted lehalacha, that if you have an animal that is created through Sefer Hayitzira, I assume it's not so relevant for most of us because we don't really know how to do this, but if you have an animal that's miraculously created, we would assume that that animal is not fleshig. Let's go to our parsha this week. We read the difficult story about Yosef and his brothers and how they're fighting with each other. And the pasuk tells us, Vayave Yosef es dibasam ra'a el avihem. Yosef brings this terrible news about his brother, And he reports back to his father about what's going on in the family. Says Rashi, what did he say about them? What were they doing wrong? So Rashi writes in number Beis, Hayamagi La'aviv. Yosef comes back and reports to his father, do you know what your children are doing? Your children are eating Avram and Achai. So ask the Shalah HaKadosh, how can it be? The Shvatim, the children of Yaakov Avinu, don't know that one of the Sheva Mitzvahs B'nai Noach is that you're not allowed to eat an animal while it's alive. You cannot just rip off a limb. You have to first properly kill the animal and then you can eat it. Were Yaakov Avinu's children, the great Shiftei Ka, were they really engaged in this act of Avram and Achai? How is it possible? And if they weren't, did Yosef lie? Did he make up a story? Did he fabricate this just to make them sound worse? When he reported back to his father, says the Shalah HaKadosh, here was the problem. Yosef didn't know that they had created their own animal. So when he saw them ripping a limb off, they were ripping a limb off an animal that wasn't really an animal. It was a miraculous animal. There's no Isser, Avram, and Achai when you're dealing with an animal of this nature. And therefore, that was the discrepancy. Yosef thought it looked like an animal. And therefore, he reports back to his father, look how rotten your children are. Look what they're doing. But the brothers of Yosef said, this is not a problem. This is not a real animal. And there's nothing to be concerned about at all. Once again, you see that when you have something that is created through Sefer Yetzirah, a miraculous conception, so to speak, we would assume that this is not considered to be fleshigs at all, even though it looks like an animal and it has all what we would assume are the same qualities of a regular animal. Now, let us continue. Some achronim have a discussion. Let's say you have one of these kinds of animals and you now want to use its skin to create a pair of tefillin or a mezuzah. Would that be acceptable or not? After all, the Torah says you need to have skin of a kosher animal. Is this a kosher animal? Well, it's not treif, but it's not kosher. It's not anything. So that's a major discussion. There is an interesting comment that the Shalah HaKadosh makes as well. We know Moshe Rabbeinu passed away which day of the week? Shabbos. That's why Shabbos afternoon when we daven mincha, we say tzidkas chatzedek. Every Shabbos afternoon, we basically make a kel male for Moshe Rabbeinu. That's what tzidkas chatzedek is all about. We commemorate the fact that he died on Shabbos afternoon. So the Shalah HaKadosh says that's very problematic because Moshe Rabbeinu dies on Shabbos. However, we're told that on the last day of Moshe Rabbeinu's life, which was Shabbos, he wrote 13 Sifrei Torah. Now, aside from the fact, how in the world does a person write 13 Sifrei Torah in a lifetime? Forgetting about it one day, how did he write it on Shabbos? There's a malach of Kosev on Shabbos. You're not allowed to write. So how did Moshe Rabbeinu do it? Writes the Shalah, no problem. Moshe Rabbeinu did what we refer to as Hashbas HaKulmus. He figured out some magical way, and he got the pen to start writing by itself. And therefore, he didn't violate the Avera of Ksiva B'Shabbos. He didn't violate the Malach of Kosev because he didn't write. Now, the question is, if he didn't write, then how is it a kosher Sefer Torah? Right? Today, this is a major discussion when you have the machine that can write a Sefer Torah more beautifully than any sofer can, I would imagine. It's a major controversy whether or not such a mechanism is acceptable or not. Well, it seems that Moshe Rabbeinu did it, and it seems that those Sefer Torah were okay. He had his technology of the time, which allowed for the Sefer Torah to be written by its own, by itself. Would that be acceptable or not? But either way, says the Shalah, such a thing would not be considered to be an act of writing, because he didn't actually do it. And if it happened miraculously through some way that he made that happen, that's not called his being involved in the act of writing at all. There is a very surprising discussion in the Chacham Tzvi, and it's quoted in the Mishneh Berurah. The Mishneh Berurah is usually very relevant, and the Mishneh Berurah talks about all of the intricacies of our day-to-day lives and all of the different cases that can present themselves. So he talks about something which I would imagine has never confronted any of us. You come to shul, and there's only 9 men for the minyan, and we're stuck. Well, can we count a golem for the 10th person? Very strange discussion. Ask the Mishneh Berurah, would we be able to count a golem? Would you consider a golem to be a human being? Would you consider a golem to be a Jew? We've all heard these stories about a golem over the years. Nobody really knows what the story is about it, but the Gemara says, Rav Bara Gavra, the Gemara says that Rav on one occasion decided it would be nice to have a friend in the world, so he created one. And then it says he got angry at him because Lo Havi Kamishtoi Bahadei, he couldn't carry on a conversation with this friend. Just, he created him and he was taking walks with him, but he couldn't talk back to him. So he says he was so frustrated, Vahargo, he went and he killed him. So it seems, writes the Chacham Tzvi, that that person who's created miraculously is not called a person. Otherwise, how can this Amor in the Gemara go and murder the person who he created? It must be you're not a real human being. Now, as we mentioned a few weeks ago, Rabbi Glatt has said, I said this a few weeks ago, and people had a misunderstanding. Rabbi Glatt said that there was research done about the fetal lamb that was conceived in a real mother, but then they extracted the fetal lamb and they put it into an external womb, an external uterus, and the lamb grew to full term, a totally healthy lamb. And okay. It hasn't lived a full life yet, but the question, what? Right, but it grew to full term, and the research seems to indicate that in the next couple of years, it might be possible to do this for human beings as well. So if there will be a woman who can't carry a pregnancy or who just doesn't want to carry a pregnancy, perhaps they can extract the embryo very early on, put it into this external uterus, and allow it to grow externally. And the question is that child going to be considered a child? Is that considered to be a human being? What is that? How do we view such a thing? These are questions that are real questions. And again, we do have sources that seem to indicate a way of thinking about them, but it's a surprising discussion regardless. We have a fascinating Gemara Maseches Chagiga, where the Gemara says, and much of what I'm saying today is from the many, many conversations over the years that I've had with my father about these topics, many conversations I've had with Rav Asher Weiss about these issues. This is a very richly discussed topic in many different areas, as you'll see. So the Gemara has a very interesting question. The Gemara says, if you have a Kohen Gadol, so it says he has to marry a virgin. Well, ask the Gemara, what if he finds a virgin woman who happens to be pregnant? Can he marry her? Now, how is that possible? Right? So ask the Gemara, we don't believe in immaculate conception, right? So how is it possible that you can have a woman who is a virgin and yet she is still impregnated? What kind of question is that? Well, let's look together. Says the Gemara in number Vav, Rabbeinu Chananel, who is one of the commentaries on the side of the Gemara, number Vav, in honor of Chanukah, let's have a little fun. Calm down, everybody. So the Gemara says we have this kind of reality where you can have this question that the Kohen Gadol, is he allowed to marry this woman or not? Is that acceptable? Says Rabbeinu Chananel, look at number Vav. Again, on the side of the page of the Gemara, he explains. Kigon, how is this possible? Sheyarad ish ba'osam batya. They used to have a bathhouse, a swimming pool. So a man went into the swimming pool, and somehow his sperm ended up by the next customer. How that's possible, writes Rabbeinu Chananel, ze maisa nisimhu. He says, this is impossible. This is miraculous. I've never seen such a thing, he says. And we all know that it's pretty much an impossibility. But says Rabbeinu Chananel, should you have such a case, in the abstract, should you have such a case, eina tamei leida. Let's say she carries through the pregnancy, she ends up giving birth. So the Torah generally says after a woman gives birth, she is now considered to be tamei. She now has to wait until she can become tahor once again and go to the mikvah. But, says Rabbeinu Chananel, this woman who conceived in such an unusual manner would not follow the regular rules of tumah. So the Torah says, Isha ki tazriya, listen carefully to the way the pasuk is structured. You have a woman who becomes pregnant. V'yalda zachar, then she gives birth to a baby boy. Then the Torah gives us all of the rules of how long she needs to wait until she can become tahora once again. Uvayom hashmini yimo besar arlasa. On the eighth day after this baby boy is born, they should do a brismila. Says the Gemara, Bayom hashmini means under all conditions. You do the brismila on the eighth day, even if the eighth day happens to be Shabbos. The brismila is more important than Shabbos, and he will push Shabbos aside and allow the brismila to be done. That is what the Torah says. Says Rabbeinu Chananel, since this woman is missing the first stage in the game, Isha ki tazriya, she didn't become pregnant in a normal way. This is not what the Torah ever envisioned for a pregnancy, and therefore we would assume the rest of the pasuk doesn't apply either. She is not considered to be subject to the laws of impurity after she gives birth. That's what Rabbeinu Chananel writes. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, most recently, took this 100 steps further, and he said, what if you have today what we refer to as this miraculous child that is born and conceived through IVF? Isn't that the same? A woman somehow can be pregnant without being intimate with her husband. How amazing is that, says Rav Shlomo Zalman. Is that any less of a miracle than what's described here in the Gemara? And Rav Shlomo Zalman says, all you need to do is just adapt it to our conditions today and understand that is exactly what's being described. And if anyone from 1,000 years ago would come around and see what we do today, they would say, this is the most miraculous thing in the world. How is it possible you can have a single woman who becomes pregnant? How can that be? And yet, we see it today all the time. This is not something that we consider to be such a miracle, although when you think about it, it is. But an IVF child, as miraculous as that is, has become so common and so prevalent that we've all taken for granted that this is what's done. Well, ask Rav Shlomo Zalman, when you have a woman who became pregnant, who conceived through IVF, what would you say when that woman gives birth? And that child now is a baby boy. And the Torah says, "Vayom hashmini yimol b'sar lasi." You're supposed to do the bris on the eighth day after the child is born. Even if the eighth day is on Shabbos, says Rav Shlomo Zalman, I'm not totally convinced that you're allowed to do a bris for that child on a Shabbos. I'm not totally convinced of that, because after all, the Torah says, the only time that we allow the bris to be done on Shabbos is when everything happened in the natural course of events, but this is not natural. This is not the regular way. And therefore, he's not sure about whether or not we should assume that this is an acceptable way. Now, I've spoken many times with Rav Asher Weiss about that issue, and although Rav Shlomo Zalman raises this possibility and believes that maybe a bris milah should not be done on the eighth day if it's Shabbos, if the child was conceived through IVF, which would be, can you imagine? Somebody has a child, and usually it's pretty private if they've been through fertility treatments, and then when they call the mohel to ask if he can do a bris, he's going to have to start asking, well, how did you conceive? That's going to make life very uncomfortable, and it's a piece of information they don't want to share. And let's say that bris is supposed to be on Shabbos, and the mohel says, I'm sorry, I cannot do it. Rav Shlomo Zalman said, I'm not sure if you're allowed to do it on Shabbos. It might be Chilul Shabbos. What are they going to tell everybody? Why is it being pushed off to Sunday? For what reason? Okay, but that's not embarrassing. That's not a private piece of information. If a woman has a C-section, you share that. I mean, if you want to. But if a woman becomes pregnant through IVF, that's usually a piece of information that people are not comfortable sharing. So that is a very troubling issue. I was once speaking somewhere in a community, and I was asked to talk about bris milah. So I spoke about everything normal about bris milah, but for 2.5 minutes in the shiur, I just mentioned this in passing. So there's a guy who was sitting there who turns white in the face, and I was like, oh no. So he comes over to me after the shiur, and he says, were you serious about that? I said, I think it's serious. So he tells me, well, I want you to know, we have two baby boys. Both of them were conceived through IVF. Both of them were born on Shabbos. Both of their bris milahs were done on Shabbos. And my wife is now pregnant with our third boy through IVF as well. And my question is, he said, what is the halacha if you went ahead and you did the bris milah on Shabbos when perhaps you should not have? Does that bris milah have validity or not? Because the Gemara has a concept in Maseches Temura called Milsa Diyama Rachmana Lo Savid I Avid Lo Mahani. If a person does something that the Torah said you're not allowed to do, perhaps even if you got the desired outcome, perhaps it doesn't count. Perhaps it doesn't work. Now there are very difficult parameters to figure out when that applies and when it doesn't. But he asked me, "What would you say?" I said, "I have no idea. It's way beyond me." But I said, "I think in this case you can rely on Rav Asher Weiss certainly once it's done already." And I wouldn't worry. Rav Asher Weiss argued, and I think it's a very sensible, logical argument. He said, even if that is the case, that we accept this Rabbeinu Hananel's interpretation, which is subject to debate in the first place, but even if that's the case, he said, today, we do not look at IVF as being something miraculous anymore. We don't look at this as being so unusual. We look at this as pretty much, you know, a regular phenomenon that we hear about all the time. And therefore, it's unfortunate when it has to be done, and it's very costly, and it's a difficult process and procedure to go through. But at the same time, he says, you cannot say that that is the same as the case that the Gemara describes here of this virgin woman who somehow becomes pregnant in a bathtub. That is a miraculous conception. That is not something that is the norm at all. Now, when we talk about all of these unusual cases, Rav Asher Weiss pointed out to me a number of years ago that it's important to note the comment of Rabbi Chanan Wasserman. He was one of the great, great tzaddikim who was killed in the Holocaust. Rabbi Chanan writes something where he says that everything we're discussing really boils down to one point, and that is the following. Look at number Zion. Nira, he says, when we talk about the laws of Shabbos, Hadapater b'Shabbos ba'osa kila achar yad. Why is it that on Shabbos, if I do a malacha in an unusual manner, why is it that I'm not going to be punished for doing that malacha? It doesn't mean that it's allowed. But why am I not going to get the death penalty that I would get if I really did a malacha the right way? I mean, the normal way. And why is it, he says, that should be the case by Shabbos. He writes, Eino din miyuchad biyisurei Shabbos. This is not limited to the laws of Shabbos. This is something that applies to the entirety of Torah. Alakein hu b'chol dinei haTorah. Shalom nemru ela kefi derech haragil. The laws of the Torah were given for normal circumstances. So when the Torah said you're not allowed to do a malacha on Shabbos of writing, it means when you write the normal way. When the Torah said you're not allowed to cook on Shabbos, it means if you cook in the normal way, and therefore says the Gemara, let's say you're a bishel bechama, let's say a person puts a frying pan, you live in Arizona and it's boiling hot, and you put a frying pan with an egg outside in the sun, and you know that it's going to somehow cook the egg, that is not called bishel. Even though you get the same result, you get the same outcome. Says the Gemara, that is not called bishel. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach was discussing, Rav Moshe Feinstein has tshuvas about what is the status of a microwave today. Microwave is not an oven, but he says it's become the norm to cook in that. Is that called the malacha of cooking on Shabbos or not, if I stick something in the microwave? So he says, absolutely, because that's the norm. It is not normal to cook an egg on the radiator in your house. It is not normal to cook an egg on putting it out in the sun. And therefore, that is not called the malacha of bishul on Shabbos. And therefore, says Rabbi Chanan Wasserman here, this is the halacha with regard to all the laws of the Torah, that the laws of the Torah were said and stated for normal situations, for the regular way that things are done. If you figure out how to get around it and do something in such an unusual manner, that's not called violating the law of the Torah, because the Torah was not stated for that kind of scenario, for that kind of circumstance. And therefore he says, the same would apply, the Gemara tells us, you're not allowed to eat certain foods. Let's say non-kosher meat. You're not allowed to eat non-kosher meat. What if you eat it? Shalo kederech achilaso. You do something to it which is not the normal way to eat it. Like the Gemara says, karcho besiv, for example, you wrap it up in plastic and you eat it like that. Nobody eats food like that. That's not the norm. Or you have other kinds of ways which are called shalo kederech achilaso. You're not eating the normal way that food is supposed to be eaten or consumed. That is not called violating the avera of machalas asuros, because that is not what the Torah intended when it said you're not allowed to eat this item. The Torah only said you're not allowed to eat it normally, and you're not allowed to write on Shabbos normally, and you're not allowed to cook on Shabbos normally. And all the halachas of the Torah, says Rabbi Chanan, were said for the normal course of events. And therefore he says, this is the reason why all of this discussion is perhaps boiling down to the same point. If you create a golem which is not normal, that person cannot count for a minyan, because that person is not a regular human being. If you have this meat that is created in the abnormal fashion, and that is not the regular way that we ever perceive meat to be, that is not considered to be fleishig. All this comes to the same point, and it really boils down to what we say by the laws of Shabbos. If something is done in a very unusual fashion, it is not called what the Torah prohibited at all. Now, let's get to the issue of synthetic meat. And I find this to be a very fascinating issue. We have, now, the scientists have figured out how to have meat that is grown in a lab, cultured meat, which basically is produced from a stem cell of an animal, and they grow into a muscle tissue, ultimately resulting in a real piece of meat. Now, this meat, at some point, is meant to be an alternative to the regular meat that we expect to eat or we expect to buy in the store. And the question that comes out is a number of issues. Number one, let's say that stem cell is taken from a non-kosher animal. So would the meat that results from that whole experimentation, would that be considered to be kosher meat? Or is it non-kosher meat based on the origin of where the stem cell came from? That's question number one. Question number two that we have to think about is, even if it comes from a kosher animal, would you assume that it's considered to be fleishig? Is it really considered to be a piece of meat? Now, the first issue that we need to deal with is, does the halacha even recognize something that is microscopic? Which is a major area of study. It's a major area of discussion. We have a concept that the halacha discusses in Maseches Kiddushin, that the Gemara says the Kohanim wear very special clothing, the Bigdei Kohuna, when they do the service in the Beis HaMikdash. What about after the Kohen finishes his job for the day, and now he's exhausted, he's ready to go to sleep? Ask the Gemara, does he have to make sure to take his clothing off the moment that he finishes doing the work, because you're not allowed to wear those clothing for your own purposes, and now you're ready to go to sleep? Ask the Gemara, does he have an obligation to remove the clothing the moment he finishes doing the work for the day? The Gemara says, absolutely not. Why? Because lo nitna Torah lemalachei hasheris. The Torah does not expect us to be angels. The Torah expects us to live as human beings. That's not normal, that the Torah should expect a person, the moment you finish your job, you should just strip out of your clothing right in the middle of the Beis HaMikdash, the second you finish offering the last carbon of the day. It doesn't make sense. The Torah assumes you're going to go downstairs to wherever the locker rooms were, you're going to go take a shower and change into whatever clothing you want to wear, and that's considered reasonable, that's normal. And therefore, says the Gemara, we have this concept of lo nitna Torah lemalachei hasharis. The Torah expects us to be human beings, and the Torah does not expect us to live lives like angels. The Gemara says in Maseches Sukkah, if you look at number Ches, Yardu hagashamim. Let's say I'm sitting in the sukkah, and it starts to rain. Me'em asai mutar lifnos. When am I allowed to go into my home? Says the Gemara, mishatisrach hamekafe. When my food starts to become not inedible, but it's uncomfortable to eat the food like that. When you have raindrops falling into it, it's going to make the soup cold or whatever it might be. So you don't have an obligation to continue to stay in the sukkah. However, one of the Achronim says, do I have an obligation now to run out of the sukkah the second that it starts raining because now I'm having benefit from the sukkah that I wasn't allowed to have? You're not allowed to use the sukkah for your own purposes. So he says, no. You're expected to live life like a normal human being, and therefore you're allowed to collect your plates, you're allowed to collect your chairs, you're allowed to do whatever it takes to go about this in the normal way that human beings would do so, moving back into a home. And he says this is all based on the principle of lo nitna Torah lemalachei hasharis. So we have major discussions today about checked vegetables. Checked vegetables are something that we need to be careful about, that vegetables sometimes are infested with bugs, and we need to be careful about what we eat and what we don't and how we check it. However, let's say we have gone through the reasonable protocol of how you're supposed to check the vegetables. Do I have to be so overly concerned even after I checked and I put it in the soap or whatever it is that's recommended for normal people to do? Do I still have to be concerned? You know what? Forget it. I'm just not going to eat this lettuce. I'm not going to eat this vegetable because I'm so concerned. And even though I checked it, who knows? Writes one of the Achronim, look at number Tess in the Sheilas Yaibitz. What if you're one of those people who did what you're expected to do and you checked what's considered to be the norm in our community for checking, whatever that might be? Achein, kol shenivdak velo nimtza bo. If I check the lettuce or whatever it might be, and I try to find whatever might be in there and I see nothing, and there's no infestation, shuv ein lachosh, there is no reason any longer to be concerned. Ve'achil naminei shufri de shufri. And the greatest of Jews are allowed to eat this lettuce. V'hachi chazina, the rabbanan kishishai umari de'uvda. He said, this is what I've observed by great people of our generation. V'hamachmir yachmir la'atzmo. You want to be machmir, do whatever you want. But he says, you have no obligation any further. If you did what's considered to be reasonable and expected in the community, aval ein lahachbid b'chumr yaseira ala tzibur. There's no reason to be more machmir than what you are expected and obligated to do. As he says, the Torah is hard enough to observe. With whatever the Torah expects us to do, there's no reason to take it further. So Rabbi Moshe Feinstein has a very important comment, and that is, how are we ever able to use vinegar? How is vinegar created? Microbes. And we know that those are bugs. Now, they're microscopic bugs, but that's how vinegar is created. That's how it comes to be. So how is it, asked Rabbi Moshe, that you're ever able to use vinegar? And the answer is, he says, the Torah expects us to be human beings. If it's something that you cannot see with the naked eye, it's something you don't have an obligation to worry about. And the same goes, how are you ever able to breathe? Don't you know that there are all kinds of things swimming around in the air that you might not be able to see? The answer is, well, lo nitna Torah lemalachei hasharis. The Torah does not expect us to live life like angels, it expects us to live life like human beings. And therefore, says Rav Moshe, this is why the vinegar is acceptable. And the same goes, you know, there are people in this neighborhood who have children who learn in certain yeshivas, and they come back for Sukkot time, and they all show up at my door before Sukkot. They want me to look at their esrogim. Tell you the truth, I'm not the expert on esrogim, and I tell every person who comes to my house that I don't consider myself to be an expert. However, I do know that every year when I was a child and through my adult life, I go to buy a lulav and esrog with my father. I think he is an expert, and I have to tell you that it doesn't take us more than 5 minutes to ever pick out an esrog. It takes us much longer to pick out a lulav, because having a kosher lulav is much harder than having a kosher esrog. The esrog always takes 5 minutes. But how much do I have to go out of my way to check the esrog? Obviously, there are certain qualifications and guidelines of what a kosher esrog should be and could be. However, do I have to go there in the store with a microscope? I don't know if you've ever gone esrog shopping in Israel, but you see people come with a loop, and they're looking so carefully. What are they going to find? And the Mabit and other Achronim say you have no obligation to do that. It's a wonderful, nice practice. You can do what you want. But he says you have no obligation to do so because That's not what the Torah expects of you. The Torah wants you to be a human being. So Rav Moshe was asked the question. It says that the tefillin boxes, the squares of the tefillin have to be exactly square. So my father said that there was a dentist who he knew, who he said every time he comes into shul, you know, he's a dentist, so he sees teeth with precision, and he sees, I don't know, I guess he's used to this, said every time he comes into shul, he goes crazy, because he looks at people's tefillin, and he sees, this is not straight, and that's not straight, and it's a little bit off here, a little bit off there, which most regular people wouldn't be able to see. So he says, do I have an obligation to go start pointing out to everybody, you have to get that fixed, because it's not a real box, and that's not a real square, and this is not a real rectangle? Or do you say, no, you happen to be a specialist, and you're a dentist, so you might see things that most of us aren't able to see and understand right away, but for the most of the naked eyes in the room, we would assume that we're seeing a square, and we all think that it's a square, and therefore it is. So Rav Moshe writes, yes, you have no obligation to start going around and measuring with a microscope and figuring out with whatever that is, a measuring instrument, to really consider whether or not this is exactly square. Do you think in the times of Chazal that's what they had? Of course not. They made a square, what they considered to be, to the best of their opinion, a real square, and therefore he says, this is the guiding principle. So the question is here, when we talk about the stem cell research, do we assume that since the whole origin of what it is that they're doing is all on microscopic level, maybe we should say, the halacha doesn't even recognize it. It's like it's not even here. The same way the halacha doesn't recognize the blemish in the esrog when you only see it through a microscope, and the halacha does not recognize the bugs in the vinegar, and that's why you're allowed to eat it, and the halacha in all these other areas does not recognize something that is not visible to the naked eye, maybe we should say that when it comes to DNA samples, or when it comes to all these kinds of stem cell research, maybe we should say that the halacha has nothing to say about it because it's not nira le'einayim. Says Rav Shlomo Zalman, that is preposterous. Why? Because although it's true, by all these other areas of halacha that we don't expect you to live life like an angel, but he says here, that cannot be applied. Here, writes Rav Shlomo Zalman, you are going out of your way to do the scientific research on that which is not visible. So you can't say it's insignificant. It's not insignificant. In this case, my focus and my attention and my area of study is on that which is in this microscopic test tube or whatever it might be. Look at the bottom line. Rav Shlomo Zalman says, Be'inyan she'eloso. Somebody asked him a question about genetic engineering, and he said, Shemachnisim chalkikei ta'im, mibriya achas l'shnia. He says, you do all kinds of genetic engineering, and you take one strand of DNA from one thing and one strand from another, and now you plant it into the ground, or whatever it might be. You want to change the strand of how it's going to grow the next time around. So you take a DNA from this plant and another DNA sample from the other, you put it together. He says, Al yidei zeh lahatir iser kilayim. Maybe this should get around the problem of planting two different items together. Mikivan she'ein chalkikim elu nira le'ein ha'adam. He says, the bottom line is, you cannot see these DNA samples, you cannot see the research that's being done, and therefore he says, since you can't see with the naked eye and you need a microscope, maybe we should say that there's no problem at all. However, he writes, Kivan she'anashim mitaplim b'chakikim eila. He says, since we are actually doing the research with these, u'ma'avir mosam mimin echad l'sheni, and you're putting them from one plant into another and from one test tube into another, in such a case, harei zeh chashiv mamish kenira le'inayim. You cannot say that this is comparable to all the other cases that we've described, because in this case, I specifically want that I should pay attention to that which is not visible. I specifically work under a microscope because that's what I'm trying to accomplish. And therefore, the same would go in our case here. When you have the stem cell meat, you cannot just knock the whole issue off by saying, well, it's not something visible, and therefore we would assume that I don't have to worry about it. Halacha has nothing to say because halacha does not recognize that which is not visible. That might be true in general. But when it's the invisible item that I'm actually trying to accomplish something with, and that's what I'm doing the research on, writes of Shlomo Zalman, which is a very logical and sensible argument, as he always does in every area of halacha, he says, this cannot be applied to our case. So now that we assume that something that is handled on a microscopic level and is actually trying to be used for whatever it is that we're attempting to accomplish, we assume that the halacha does have to recognize that. And if that is the case, we come to our shaila here. So you have a stem cell that is taken from this piece of meat. And the question is, now that you put it into a test tube and into a lab and the petri dish, whatever's used, and now you grow it to become a real piece of meat. So is that piece of meat considered to be fleishigs? What is that? So I've discussed this with my father a number of times. And his feeling is, why is that different than this miraculous animal that Avraham Avinu created? Where clearly we're told that that animal was not considered to be fleshig, and that's the right that Avraham Avinu had to serve it with milk and butter and cheese. Why is this different than all those cases that we said about creating something in such an abnormal fashion, in a maisa nisim, the woman who becomes pregnant from a bathtub, it's not normal at all, and therefore we would consider that to be an abnormal conception. So too over here, we would assume that this is so unusual, it's not the norm at all, and therefore we would consider it to be something that cannot be deemed as fleshig. However, even if that might be the case, we still have an issue of maras ha'ayin. Maras ha'ayin means if somebody walks into your house, they don't know the difference between this piece of meat and that piece of meat. All they see is that on your table you're serving meat together with milk, and that would be something that would pose a halachic problem. Now, if you assume that the only issue here is a maras ha'ayin consideration, like my father suggests, that has extreme relevance. Let's come back into the story of Hanukkah. The Gemara says in Maseches Shabbos, when you light the Hanukkah candles and you have a home that passes on two different sides of the street. So let's say I have a house that takes up the whole Peninsula Boulevard, and I have one window on that side of the street and one window on this side of the street. If somebody's driving by my window on Glen Drive, they don't know that I lit Hanukkah candles on the window that is facing Peninsula Boulevard. And the same goes in the opposite direction. So the Gemara says, if you have a home like that, you have to make sure that you light Hanukkah candles on both sides of the house in order that people who pass by on either side will know that Schechter lit the Hanukkah candles tonight. Otherwise, it's a problem of Maras Ha'ayin. 1 minute. Otherwise, it's a problem of Maras Ha'ayin because people are going to think that you didn't do the mitzvah that you were supposed to do. That is the halacha. That is what the Gemara says. There's no doubt about it. The Ran only adds and he says, well, when you're lighting that second Hanukkah menorah on the other side of the house, you don't need to make a new bracha because that's not really the mitzvah of Hanukkah. You did your mitzvah already. The only reason I'm lighting this is because of the yentas outside of my house who are going to think that I didn't light the menorah. So therefore, says the Ran, you don't make a bracha on such a thing, but you do need to light on both sides of the house in order that people passing on both sides of the street will be able to see that you have done your mitzvah that you are obligated to do. However, writes the Ramah, why is it that today we have big houses and sometimes our houses go on two ends of a street and nobody's doing this? How come we don't find that people are lighting on different ends of the house to make sure that everybody sees them? The answer, says the Ramah, is because we no longer light outside. The Gemara says, and in Israel they still do it, you're supposed to light outside of your home, right at the Pesach Beis HaMibachutz. You're supposed to light right at the entrance to your house, outside. Well, there, says the Gemara, if you have an entry on this side of the street and an entry on that side of the street, so the assumption is somebody who's passing on this side doesn't realize that you have another entry on the other side, so you have to light on both sides. However, says the Ramah, today, when we all light inside of our homes, and the real point of the lighting is that the people inside of the home should be able to experience the lighting of the Hanukkah candles, there's an added bonus that people outside, but really the focus today is on those who are inside of our homes, says the Ramah, we no longer have to worry about the people who are passing outside. Nobody looks into everybody's windows to see, well, did they light, did they not light? When it was so obvious and in the open, back in the times of the Gemara, when you passed by the front doorstep of someone's home and you were able to see whether they lit or not, then that can raise some questions about you. But now today, where people light inside of their living room, inside of their dining room, wherever it might be, and the focus of today's lighting is on the members of my own home, in such a case, says the Ramah, we no longer have to worry about what people on the outside are going to say because we don't expect them to be looking into our house so carefully. That's what he says. Which means that this consideration of Maras Ha'ayin in general is something that is dependent on Lefi HaMakom VeHazman. Give just an example. We live here in New York. People are familiar with religious Jews and what a religious Jew stands for and what he does or does not do. So let's say I'm in Manhattan and I need a drink. I walk into a McDonald's. Anybody who sees me doing that doesn't think that I'm going in when I'm wearing a yarmulke, when I look like a religious person, yes, and when you wear the baseball cap at the baseball game, everybody also knows you're a Jew. But when you do that, nobody thinks that you're going to buy a non-kosher sandwich at McDonald's. Everybody knows either you're going to use the men's room, the ladies' room, or you're going in to get a drink. In New York, we're all familiar with this concept. There's nothing to be concerned about. Another person who sees you doesn't start to raise objections. What if I go visit Kansas, or, I don't know, somewhere out in the Midwest, where they might not be so familiar with religious Jews and their practices. All they know is religious Jews only eat kosher. So you're wearing a yarmulke on your head, you look like a religious Jew, and you walk into a McDonald's and say, hey, what's this about? So yes, there might be an issue of Maras Ayin there. even though there's no issue of Maris Ayin here, because it's just not relevant to our community. The Rush already writes this a few hundred years before the Ramah. He says, very simply, there is a Mishnah where we're told you're not allowed to have, the Pasuk says, you're not allowed to have shatnez in a garment. You're not allowed to have wool and linen woven in together. Says the Mishnah, what about silk? What would he say? No problem. Why would there be an issue of silk? That's not wool, it's not linen. So you can weave the silk in with everything else. However, the Mishnah says, people aren't really familiar with silk. They're going to think that it's wool or it's linen, and therefore the Mishnah says you can't weave the silk together with the wool or the linen, because people are going to draw a mistaken conclusion, and they're going to assume that you're violating the din of kilayim. Writes the Rush. Today, when we are all quite familiar with the difference between silk and wool and linen, and nobody's confusing all of these different species or all of these different items, and when you see a garment, you see what somebody's wearing, you know whether it is that they're wearing something that is silk on the outside or they're wearing something that's a different material, there is no longer a consideration of Maris Ayin in this case. And the Rush says, it's not conservative Judaism, it means that Maris Ayin is something that was created in order that people should not suspect you of doing something that you're not supposed to do. But where everybody around me is aware of what it is that I'm doing, and nobody has any objection, nobody has any question about what I'm doing, in such a case, writes the Rush, the whole Maris Ayin falls by the wayside. So what's interesting here is, if you would say that this kind of meat really is considered to be pariv, but the only reason we have to be careful about it is because of Maris Ayin, it could be that in 10 years' time, when this becomes so popular, and when you walk into somebody's house, your basic assumption is that they have this meat and not real meat, maybe that would now change the halacha, and it would say that there's no longer an issue of Maris Ayin, which could be amazing. I'm not saying it will happen, but it's a possibility of that happening. This is all my father's perspective, and some others share the same perspective that he had. When I discussed this with Rav Asher Weiss on a number of occasions, and the OU also was in consultation with him about it, so he didn't yet print this tshuva, but he sent it to me, and you can look at it. These are the highlights on the second side of the page. You can read it on your own, but some of it is very important. When I originally asked him, when the articles first came out and the research was being studied, he said to me, Shai, come on. If it looks like a duck, and it smells like a duck, and it quacks like a duck, then it is a duck. So how can it be? It doesn't matter how you created this thing. In the end of the day, if it looks like an animal, and everything about it is the same, and it has the same texture and the same consistency and the same taste, how is it possible to argue that this is not a piece of meat? It just doesn't make sense. I don't care how it came to be. The bottom line is, here it is. And if it's the same as the item that you otherwise would have been used to, that is fleishigs, that means it is fleishigs midaraisa. It means the Torah considers this to be a piece of meat. He said, we know that we have all kinds of chemicals today where you can make, with food coloring and with all kinds of food flavors, you can make whatever it is taste like something else. He says, yeah, well, if you have noodles that taste like bacon, I don't know, whatever it is. He's like, that's not the consistency of bacon, and it's just not it. So that's not an issue. You can have it taste like whatever you want. But he said, when you actually have something that looks the same and tastes the same and is the same, so how can you argue that it is not really going to be the same? This is a very important issue. And he writes that something, in his opinion, which he feels is a very important point to make. And in this tshuva, he gets through some of the discussion that we have. And one issue that I think he raises that is a very important one, if you look at the second to last paragraph, Achla Anias Daiti, Kal Eila Einam Ela Divrei Drush Va'agada. He says, I'm well aware of the comment that the Malbim makes with regard to Avraham Avinu, that he created the animal and it wasn't fleishig because he made it on his own. And I'm well aware of all the different sources that we have that we mention. However, he says, La'anias daiti kon eila einam ela divrei drush va'agada. That is not something that should be relied upon lehalacha. You have a story by Avraham Avinu, by the Shvatim, by Yosef, they figured out all these strange things, okay? That's not something that's relevant to our halachic process. Ve'ein lemeiden halacha min ha'agada. You cannot draw any conclusions from the way that we interpret a story in Chumash, al divrei ha'agada, the way to explain a story that we read in the pages of Chumash, that is not really a way to learn the halachic psak that will be relevant to our question that we are discussing. And that is his opinion. He feels that this is something that would be considered real meat. Look at the last paragraph. Ach, af im nekabalas divreim shebasar shenivra bederach neis al yidei sefer yitzira enoton shchita. Even let's say you disagree with my premise, that and you feel that you could draw a conclusion from that story of Avraham Avinu or any of those other miraculous stories. He says, even if that's true, nira d'shaini nidun didan, it seems that our case is totally different and you cannot compare the two. Delo Maisa Nisim Yeshkan. This is not miraculous. What Avram Avinu did was a miracle. And the same argument that he has, a logical argument by the IVF case that we spoke about, that's not miraculous. That's something we understand the science of it. If you bother to go and research it enough, you understand how it happens. And so forth, he says the same here. Lav Maisa Nisim Yeshkan. This is not a miracle. Yes, it's a breakthrough in science, but he says al shamatzu derech ki'ilu ligram l'tai basar bodedim l'israbos l'kidei kamas gedola shel basar. We have scientifically figured out a way of how we can mass produce meat without having animals. Okay, amazing, but that's not miraculous. V'nimsa de basar zeh shorasha makar b'basar tivi. It comes from a natural source. V'al pichukei ateva gadol v'hisrabe. And the way that it came to be was through natural means that we all have the ability to understand and to internalize. And therefore he says, he says, as far as I'm concerned, there is no argument otherwise. I don't understand how you can even begin to say that this is not meat. It didn't come about miraculously. It came about naturally, scientifically. This is something that we understand how it happens. It's something that looks like meat, and it is meat, and it smells like meat, and the texture is meat. And therefore he said, it would seem to me that this is real basar, that this is real meat. Now, let us just close with the question that we started with, if anyone remembers. We come to the Beis HaMikdash, and we have the Chashmonaim want to light the menorah. And they have an issue, because they only have one pach shemen, they only have one jug of oil. So as we know, a miracle happened. But what was the miracle? Ask the Beis Yosef. They had enough oil for one night. Why do we commemorate 8 nights of Chanukah, if after all, the miracle only happened for 7 nights, and the first night was not at all miraculous? So the Beis Yosef, in one of his suggestions, writes, perhaps what happened was they put a little bit of oil into the cup, and the rest of it filled with shemen nes, with miraculous oil. And therefore, he says, there was a miracle even on the first night. The entire duration of Chanukah was all miraculous. Well, if that's true, if that is the case, is that acceptable to perform the mitzvah of lighting the menorah in the Beis HaMikdash? Maybe you should say, that's like the animal that Avraham Avinu created. That's not real. And therefore, there are those who argue that that would not be sufficient. They could not have relied on that oil and lit that in the Beis HaMikdash to actually perform their mitzvah of halakas HaMenorah. They needed to do something that was using real oil, and over here they were not doing that. And therefore, there's major objection to this suggestion of the Beis Yosef. Maybe it really doesn't work. Maybe that would not be acceptable for the mitzvah of menorah on Chanukah. So Rav Chaim Soloveitchik suggested that maybe what the Beis Yosef means is they poured in a drop of oil, and the miracle was that it had like firepower. It was able to burn all night long, even though they put such a small amount of oil into the cup, it burned all night long. But to say that the cup actually filled up with miraculous oil would not fulfill the requirement of Shemen Zayizach that the Torah requires us to use. So this is the basic discussion when it comes to Chanukah, and as we said, it really opens up a major discussion that is far more expansive than Chanukah, and far more interesting than just Chanukah itself, which really has become a very relevant discussion in the last couple of months, in the last couple of years, based on the scientific research that has become more and more prevalent.